Well, thank you so much, Lyndall, for that lovely and wonderful presentation of the First Noble Truths, the first two. And we had sort of a drawing or something. So I got the, I'm happy I get the upside. I get to share the happier ones. That's kind of cool. So the third and the fourth Noble Truths. And so kind of what I'm saying is, while the truth of suffering and the cause of suffering tell us what the problem is, the third truth says that we can be free from suffering. And the fourth truth tells us how this is to be done. So this is the upside. And often a physician metaphor is used here in terms of the Four Noble Truths, with the first truth stating the disease, suffering, the second truth stating the cause of disease, the third truth stating the cure, and the fourth truth, the medicine. And that might seem odd to have the medicine after the cure, because you think it'd be before. But that's because the cure, freedom of liberation, is also an aspiration or a point of faith, if you will, a confidence. And the medicine is our practice on the path. So you can say the medicine helps us direct ourselves toward the cure. And this sequence is helpful in our practice, because the more we can kind of internalize and visualize the goal of liberation, of freedom, then the more sense the path for getting there makes to us. I mean, we have to have a sense of where we're going, even though if we get too many strict ideas about it, that's a limitation. But we have to know where we're pointing to want to go there. And, you know, sometimes the path can be a little difficult. And so this is helpful to have the sense of direction. So in terms of the third noble truth, the end of suffering, kind of a paradox about it is that it's simultaneously infinitely vast and very immediate. And that's actually helpful. And this paradox is sort of an edge in my own practice as I, you know, try to navigate how we move forward. Because on the one hand, this goal of liberation, of freedom, is immediately accessible. And at the other hand, it's so huge that it inspires us to move forward infinitely. I mean, where the Buddha was at, we can't even conceive. And so it keeps us going. But at the same time, it works right now. So both things are true. So the Buddha first spoke of the Four Noble Truths while offering his first sermon shortly after he awakened. And he gave it to his former companions, the five ascetics, under the trees of Sarnath in India. It set the stage a tiny bit. After awakening the Buddha, he cast his mind about to see whom he might teach. And after a few false starts, he realized that his five ascetics were in Sarnath, which is just outside the holy city of Varanasi on the Ganges. And so he walked 152 miles over stages, over days, to reach them. And he gave this wonderful first sermon, very much worth reading. But he said, in terms of this third noble truth, he said, "Now this, bhikkhus, is a noble truth of the cessation of suffering. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving, the giving up and relinquishing of it, freedom from it, non-reliance on it." So he's really pointing us in a direction of freedom, freedom from craving. And as many of you know, the Sanskrit word for liberation is nirvana, while in Pali, the word is nibbana. And this brings us to kind of a helpful metaphor, because villagers in India often talk about waiting for the rice to become nibbana, for the rice to become nibbana, which means waiting for it to cool enough so they can eat it. And so this, you can say that this third noble truth is about cooling, you know, cooling the attachments and aversions and ignorance that bind us to the wheel of samsara and make us suffer. And what's wonderful about this cooling is that, you know, it's doable, it's accessible. Every day, every time you touch into mindfulness, cooling happens. I mean, consider, you know, some of your stuck places are stuck places and how the heat of it makes us cling, whether it's attraction or aversion. And then sometimes you probably, well, we've all had experience when we're mindful of that, it just kind of opens up a little bit and it's not so sticky. And you can say there's a moment of coolness there, a moment of freedom. So I think it's really worthwhile to consider that a hint or a taste of nibbana, kind of a way the practice works for us day by day, moment by moment. You know, in the middle of a debate with the person we love most, we can be mindful right there. It can be a little cooler, which is really helpful. Ajahn Buddhadasa, as you may know, a great Thai master, no longer with us. In his book, Nibbana for Everyone, he talks about this, and he says, any reactive emotion that arises ceases when its causes and conditions are finished. Although it may be a temporary quenching, merely a temporary coolness, it is still Nibbana, even if only temporarily. Thus, there's a temporary Nibbana for those who can't yet avoid some defilements. It's this temporary Nibbana that sustains the lives of beings who continue hanging on to defilement. So there's a temporary Nibbana. So this third noble truth, it's, you know, it's hugely important because, like I said, we need to have a sense of where we're going and to celebrate these moments of coolness can really help us keep going. One of my teachers once said, no moment of mindfulness is wasted. And it kind of that really hit me in the heart, you know, no moment of mindfulness is wasted because it brings that coolness. At the same time, you know, there's no doubt the spiritual journey can be difficult. We're called upon to wake up to every aspect of our, you know, our tarnished conditioning to see through it. So we need at the same time kind of a brilliant sense of what's possible to keep us inspired, to keep our practice alive and moving. And that's why people live in monasteries. That's why people live with great beings, because there's someone there who is like radiantly present and you go, oh yeah, that's why I'm doing this. It's a little harder out here in the world as lay people in the 21st century, but it's still possible. And it's interesting when you read the suttas, the Buddha kind of alludes in different ways, different aspects of what he sees, even though he also avoids getting too concrete about it. And sometimes he says, he has these metaphors where he says, well, that which I'm telling you, he says like, here's a handful of sand I have here. And then, do you know how much sand there is in the Ganges? And they'll say, oh, much, much more than this handful of sand you have. And he says, well, I'm just telling you the handful of sand I see as big as all the sand in the Ganges. So that's kind of a sense of how vast awakening is. And often in the suttas, this awakening is whittled down to just this one phrase, not clinging. You know, just not clinging. And I got to admit, for me, for a long time, this seemed kind of like, I don't know, kind of a letdown, kind of like overly simplistic. Really? That's it? Just not clinging? But, you know, when you start to practice and you start to realize how much, you know, what Linda was talking about, how much clinging is, in fact, the problem. And if we could really not cling, we'd be free. And this is what the Buddha said at one point in the suttas. He refers to himself, as you may know, as a Tathagata, which means one who has gone. So he says, but monastics, the Tathagata, the Arahant, the fully enlightened one, has understood as they really are the origin and the passing away, the gratification, the danger, and the escape in the case of forms. He does not delight in forms, does not take delight in forms, does not rejoice in forms. With a change, fading away, and cessation of forms, the Tathagata dwells happily. And then he goes on through the five sense doors and ends up with, says he has understood as they real, six sense doors, excuse me, as they really are the origin and the passing away, the gratification, the danger, and escape in the case of sounds, odors, tastes, tactile objects, mental phenomena. He does not delight in mental phenomena. He does not take delight in mental phenomena, does not rejoice in mental phenomena. With the change, fading away, and cessation of mental phenomena, the Tathagata dwells happily. So he's just kind of painting a picture here of not clinging to anything. You know, everything comes at us, just not clinging to it. Doesn't mean we can't enjoy it, but not clinging to it and then dwelling happily. Because happily is, you know, it's kind of the goal, right? To have a happy life. To have a happy life. So how do we get there? Would be the normal question. And the Buddha's answer is the Noble Eightfold Path. And the good news is you're going to have a more detailed rundown on the Eightfold Path next month on the third Thursday. So I'm going to give kind of like a little bit of an overview, which hopefully will, how do I say, complement what our two colleagues, and we couldn't remember which ones they are, I apologize. But two of our, Lauren will be there. Who else, Lauren? You pointed at somebody. You're muted.
Jerry,
okay. There you go. So Lauren and Jerry will do a splendid job of the Noble Eightfold Path. But I'm going to kind of set it up a little bit, and hopefully it'll complement what they offer. And if you can't make it then, hopefully this will help out a little bit. And a kind of a fascinating aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path is, even though the Buddha taught it 2,600 years ago, as one monk speaking to five other ascetics sitting under a tree in the dirt, the eight steps are completely relevant to our lives today. It is pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing. And here's what he said. He said, "And this, monks, is the noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of suffering. Precisely this noble eightfold path. Right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration." So more broadly, these three can be grouped into the three higher trainings. And I thought I would do that in briefly, because our colleagues will probably get into the eight more when they come around. And so the three higher trainings are virtue, or ethics, meditation, and wisdom. And one of the paradoxes, another paradox here, about the old Eightfold Path, which intrigues me, has always intrigued me, is how the beginning comes around full circle to be the ending. And here I'm referring to the fact that the first and second factors of the Eightfold Path are right view and right intention, and they launch the path, but in another way, they're the result, because those are wisdom. You know, that's what we want to go to, is wisdom, but they also launch it. And that's really especially the case with right view. And I think that suggests to us just how close to us, just a breath away, wisdom really is. And it also suggests the role of hearing the Dhamma, you know, letting it in to get pointed in a fruitful direction, the role of getting a sense of where we're going so that we will go there. And then we work toward realization. You know, the going there is kind of cognitive element, but then we're pointed and we work toward realization. So we need right view and understanding of the path to be able to grow so that we realize the Four Noble Truths. Because if any of us realized the Four Noble Truths, we'd be Buddhas. I mean, a simple little list, if we really got it, we'd be Buddhas. And at the same time, the right view of wisdom's the end of the journey. Wisdom's the end of the journey. It's waking up. So at the beginning, right view is having some understanding of karma and the Four Noble Truths. That's part of the, you know, the cognitive part. And at the same time, at the end, it's prajna, which is about realizing the nature of reality, emptiness. Bhikkhu Bodhi writes, "Right view is to become a real seeing into the true nature of phenomena, previously grasped only conceptually." So that's at the end, a real seeing into the nature of reality. So I kind of love it. It does both. It gets started conceptually and is also the real seeing. And then just in terms of the other two of the three higher trainings, watching the time, we're okay. Yeah, we're good. So especially for householders like us, and this is part of what I find amazing, how well this works in the 21st century. The first of the three higher trainings, virtue or ethics, is of utmost importance. You know, we just can't or sila is the right word. So it doesn't have this sort of moral component, but it's just behaving in a way that aligns with generosity, aligns with listening to the needs of others. And we just cannot progress on the path without sila. It just don't work. You know, we may get a few, people can get a few glimpses of wisdom here and there, but they can even do so with compromised ethics to a degree, but then the end result is it doesn't work. It collapses because there's always some kind of selfing around any breach of ethics. People do stuff to get it for themselves. And, you know, sadly, there's been a number of spiritual teachers who, despite a lot of wisdom on some levels, have kind of crashed and burned because they weren't cultivating sila enough. You know, someone got abused. They put themselves before someone else in a tender place. So it is absolutely essential that we have this training of ethics. And the three elements, and I know, again, our colleagues will get into it more, but I'm just kind of skittering along the top a little bit, are right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Right speech, right action, and right livelihood. That's how what we say, and interestingly, livelihood. That always fascinated me. It almost seems like, really? Livelihood? Because he's talking to monks. They don't even have a livelihood. Why is he saying that to monks, you know? But for here, us in the 21st century, it's worth taking in. And, you know, in a sense, this path to awakening is about shedding clinging, freeing ourselves from self-grasping, so we can kind of see that in the livelihood question. And it's worth thinking about, you know, here in the 21st century in terms of what we're doing and choices we make. I'll share just a few unique things from my own experience, because the 21st century world's so interconnected. And what you do here kind of ripples down to there in funny ways. And I was, some of you know, I was a journalist for 35 years and covered aerospace for 28 years. And so I was in and out of Boeing facilities all the time and knew a lot of, you know, I knew it. There's a surprising number of Boeing workers who are Buddhist. Some of them are out on the shop floor. Some of them are engineers. I knew a bunch of different people who were Buddhist. And, you know, you could question the entire aerospace enterprise here in a time of climate change. But back then, that wasn't quite as up as it is now. But these people I knew were very sincere, and they made choices about what they did. And in particular, I know a number of them, they moved out or wouldn't go into the defense and space group, which would be building weapons. They just stuck with commercial. I mean, they made these like career choices out of respect for this noble truth about right livelihood. So it's worth, you know, it's worth looking at. It's worth looking at, seeing what we're up to. And then the last of the three higher trainings is meditation or mind. It's what moves us toward awakening. It's the tools we work with. But again, it's not the last one. The last one is waking up. This is how we get there. And this encompasses right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration or samadhi, absorption better, because concentration, you can get the idea that it's like, you know, looking down through a little teeny magnifying glass in a squinched sort of way, but it's about absorption. And one thing to note is that mindfulness and samadhi are mentioned equally here. You know, and sometimes in our tradition, mindfulness, we talk about mindfulness all the time, don't talk about absorption very much, but they go hand in hand. And in different aspects of Theravada tradition, they're taught more equally than they have been in the West kind of so far. So, you know, it's just something to think about, absorb in your own way. But, you know, absorb stability of mind and mindfulness work together. And depending on our temperament, some people have to cultivate, work harder on the stability and the mindfulness comes underneath it. Some people, they can be very stably mindful and then they are in absorption. But something to balance. It strikes me that they're both equally expressed there. So it's just this beautifully simple formula, these Four Noble Truths. The reality of clinging, the suffering that results, the cause of that clinging, or the cause of the suffering is the clinging, the promise of freedom, and the eight-step path to freedom. So it's simple, and you know, I'm really happy that we're talking about it, because it's so, it seems like it's sort of like the, you know, the two-wheeled cart, or the, well, four-wheeled cart of Buddhism. We people don't talk about that much because it seems like it's kind of basic, but it's not basic, it's intrinsic. And if we could get it, we'd be there, you know, so very much worthwhile. Going to finish up, you've probably figured out I have a proclivity of reading the Buddha's words. The Buddha said, because I share this in terms of a sense of where this takes us. The Buddha said, for those bhikkhus who are arhats, whose taints are destroyed, who have lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached their own goal, utterly destroyed the fetters of existence, become completely liberated through final knowledge, the five hindrances have been abandoned, cut off at the root, made like palm stumps, obliterated, so that they are no more subject to future arising. So, you know, may we all obliterate our attachments and be free. Let's just sit for a moment.